Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you of the views that are expressed here, and not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Pastor Billy Crone, who we've interviewed in the past, and we've started a series of interviews with him about a series of DVDs he's sent to me, and I think they're very, very important. It's called The Final Countdown, and there are actually five DVDs in each group, and you start with number 10, and you go 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. Pastor Billy feels very, very deeply about what's going on, and he has put together a program, very watchable. Of course, he gives a talk, then, of course, he gives you the biblical background, the biblical scriptures, and then he projects on the screen video clips from everyday life that will help you really understand what's going on today. And suddenly people see things unfolding. They really don't understand quite what's happening. We look at things militarily, politically, but we very, very seldom put them into their scriptural or prophetic place. We do not look at things from a scriptural point of view. Well, that's what Pastor Billy does with this set, and I will tell you that it is excellent. We actually are going to be carrying them. We offer you're going to start off with just one of them. It has five DVDs in it, and if you like it, you'll get the second one, I'm sure. Once you get started, of course, you'll want to see all of them. So we're going to start this evening with number 10, and that, of course, is the Israeli people or the state of Israel. But I'm going to let Pastor Crone tell you this story because he does it a lot better than I do. Good evening. Thanks so very much for being with us, Billy.
Thank you, Dr. Matisse. It's a pleasure to be on.
Why don't you just go ahead and pick up the story? Let's start with number 10. And this has to do with the land of Israel. So you pick up the story. How is this prophetic? Where in the scriptures are we told that one day the children of Israel would return to the Holy Land?
Well, you know, it's quite a bit throughout the Old Testament. Isaiah talks about that. Ezekiel talks about that. But I just wanted to clarify, why did I start with the Jewish people? And, you know, many people make the claim, especially the Christians, you know, because they say, hey, you Christians, you've been saying this stuff for decades now, you know, a century or more. And, you know, and you keep saying that this is the end is near, the end is near, and, you know, the media makes a mockery of it and makes fun of it and shows people going around with sandwich board signs and make them look like a bunch of goofballs. Well, yes, granted, many people have said that and unfortunately have even set dates, which is not what we're supposed to do, and that's what this series is about. It doesn't set a date. Of course not. That's not biblical. But it does give the signs to indicate when you know it's getting close, and that comes from Jesus. And with the Jewish people, that should be one of the biggest wake-up calls forever, because where I'm going with this is that one sign alone, what God is doing with the Jewish people, is what is radically different from the past, to answer the skeptic, what makes it so different. Well, the Jewish people, and what God is specifically doing with the Jewish people, should be a huge wake-up call that, yeah, granted, maybe people have been talking about this for quite some time, but this is what is different with them.
And, of course, the thing is, a part of the race of people has been out of their homeland for 2,000 years, almost 2,000 years, and suddenly goes back again. I mean, this is really a miraculous thing. I mean, certainly did the Hittites ever return to their homeland or see the other racial groups that were over there, the other tribal groups? No other tribal group has ever left their homeland and returned, and yet this was prophesied. Is this part of God's plan? Well, I'm firmly convinced it is. You can give all sorts of explanations. Oh, well, then some of them are not necessarily the seed of Abraham. Doesn't matter. Some of them are, so we'll be right back. So you pick up the story there, Billy.
Well, you know, and that's, you know, precisely it. That's what is the mind-blowing thing. In fact, the Bible is the only, if you want to relegate it to that, I don't. I think it's more than just a document. but technically it's the only document on planet Earth that has made the bold prediction specifically that the Jewish people would once again come back to the land, and yet that's exactly what the Bible did. Prior to even getting into that, because I share in the final countdown just nine prophetic signs that what God is doing with the Jewish people, and there's more, I just shared nine. But to give you an idea of how amazing it is of just nine prophecies being fulfilled in one group of people, let me set the pace for you. First of all, when it comes to the secular supposed prophets or psychics and all their predictions like Nostradamus and Edgar Cayce and all the just psychics going on today, people don't realize what their track record is. Amid hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of prophecies, biblical prophets are not known to have ever made a single error. And that's, of course, you would expect that if something's coming from Almighty God, then he's not going to lie, because that would be an attack on his character, but also the basic definition of supreme being who has to be all-knowing. And if he didn't, in fact, know, then obviously that's not God. In fact, it comes with Deuteronomy 18 says that if anybody claims to be a prophet of God and yet makes one thing wrong, back then that was punishable by the death penalty. Now listen to the odds and the track record of those people claiming to be prophets today outside the scripture. Of the top 25 psychics today, and just taking a sample of 72 of their predictions, revealed that 92% of them were totally wrong, and the remaining 8% could be easily explained away as chance or some general knowledge of circumstances. Now, counter that with the Bible, again, not just getting wrong, but let's just add them up. Not just one, not just two. What are the odds of just eight of them? Just eight of them being fulfilled in a single entity? That has been compared mathematically with the science of probability mathematics. That it's been illustrated that would be 1 in 10 to the 17th power is the action. Now, we don't realize how big of a number that is, so they've actually extrapolated that would be equivalent to a couple feet of silver dollars covering the whole face of Texas. That would be 10 to the 17th power of silver dollars. But you're not dumb. You mark one of those silver dollars with a red X. You stir the whole mass over the whole state. Okay. You hop up in a plane, and you get up there, and you mark one of the silver dollars with a red X. You chuck it out somewhere over the state of Texas. You land your plane. You go pick a guy.
I'm going to have you just to hold your thoughts right there, because I want to bring our other stations back on board and hear the conclusion. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, we're talking with Pastor Billy Crone about the prophecies having to do with the children of Israel returning to the Holy Land. And somebody had certainly worked this thing out from a probability point of view. What are the chances that all eight of these prophecies would have come to pass exactly as they were prophesied several thousand years ago? And, of course, he uses the analogy of you get a lot of silver dollars, enough to cover the entire state of Texas, to about 2 feet deep. And you take one silver dollar and you put a big red X on it, you throw it out over, fly over the state of Texas. Then you take a man, you put a blindfold on him, and tell him that he's got to go find that one silver dollar with a blindfold on. He's only got one chance for finding the dollar. I mean, does anybody out there really feel he's got to find the dollar? Pick the story up there, Pastor.
Yeah, and that's just it. And see, that's, again, I shared just nine, and there's more prophecies concerning the Jewish people, and this is just the odds for eight. And what's the chance of that guy, that blindfolded guy, getting the right one on the first try, which is the only try? That is the exact same mathematical probability of just eight prophecies all coming true in one entity. What's interesting is kind of a side note, though. They calculate up to 48 prophecies. And again, just the Jewish people, this is just one of 10 biblical topics I deal with on the final countdown. And nine of them just with the Jewish people. But if you were to say 48 prophecies being fulfilled in one entity, you're looking at a mathematical number of 1 to 10 to the 157th power. Now, we have absolutely no clue how big that number is, but to give you an estimated number of how big that is, the number of electrons in the whole universe is around 1 and 10 to the 79th power, yet 48 prophecies being fulfilled is 1 and 10 to the 157th. By the way, Jesus fulfilled around 300 prophecies. in his first coming. And he's got about 300 concerning his second coming, proving that he was the Messiah. If he fulfilled the first 300, I think he's going to do the second one. And again, this is what this is about, the final countdown. It's God's loving wake-up call to planet Earth, giving us clear indication. We don't know the exact day. He says, but you're going to know the signs. And again, starting with the Jewish people. One of the first prophecies that I share, of course, is as you illuminate earlier, was that the Jewish people would return to the Lamb. And that's exactly what the Bible says, that one day, it says, God will gather his children from the east and the west, the north and the south. He's going to bring his sons and the daughters, he's speaking about the Jewish people, to Israel from the distant corners of the earth. Now, again, as you had said earlier, that has never, ever, ever happened in the whole history of mankind. Ever since the destruction of the Jewish temple by the Romans in 70 A.D., the Jewish people have been absolutely scattered all over the earth. But and this is what makes this so different, to answer the scoffer, the skeptic, that this is what's different. To see millions of Jews return to Israel fulfilling this prophecy, that's a huge wake-up call. But not just that. If you talk about specifics, the Bible specifically said the exact order in which they would come back. First from the east, it said there, okay, in the text there, then from the west and the north and the south. And historically, that's exactly what we saw. They came first from the east in the early 1900s, then they came from the west during the mid-1900s and began moving, then from the north in the 1980s, as early as that, Russia began to allow hundreds of thousands of Jews to go back to Israel. And then from the south, Israel actually struck a deal with Ethiopia's communist government. And back in 1991, almost 15,000 were airlifted back to Israel, and they continue to come each year all over from the world, first from the east, the west, the north, the south, exactly like what the Bible says. But that's just one. The second one the Bible says, and again, notice how through all these, how specific the Bible is and not something bland that you could read just about anything into it. The second prophecy that I share is the Bible said that Israel wouldn't just come to the land again. I mean, that's huge, okay, but they would specifically become a nation again, okay? And Isaiah talks about that as well. He says that God's going to raise a flag among the nations for Israel to rally around. He's going to gather his people from the ends of the earth. Now, what's interesting, if you know the history, since about 721 B.C., about 14 different people groups have possessed the land of Israel, going back and forth and back and forth. And yet, wonder of wonders, way back when, Isaiah makes this amazing prophecy that, against all odds, Israel would be reborn. And that's the big prophetic wake-up call. That's, again, what makes it so different. May 14th, 1948, after centuries and centuries and centuries, the people who were not a people, scattered all over the earth, returned to the land, and they specifically became a nation again. In fact, prior to 1948, many Christians looked at these passages, and they didn't even really believe in themselves. What was very popular during that time, prior to 1948, was what was called replacement theology, where they believed that the church has replaced Israel, that God's done with them. And this was a huge, huge wake-up call, and it obviously shows that God is going to fulfill his promises down to the T. But it continues on. The third prophecy, the Bible says that they wouldn't just make it back to the land. They wouldn't just become a nation again. I mean, you talk about specifics. Isaiah again says that specifically they would become a nation in one day. Isaiah 66 says, who has ever seen or heard anything as strange as this? Has a nation ever been born in a single day? Has a country ever come forth in a mere moment? But by the time Jerusalem's birth pains begin, the baby will be born, the nation will come forth. And that's exactly how it happened. And May 14th, 1948, at precisely 4 p.m., you had the members of the People Council. They signed the proclamation. The declaration was made, quote, the state of Israel is established. This meeting is ended. Israel didn't just come back to the land. They did not just become a nation again, against all odds, for the first time in mankind's history, but literally, specifically, in one day, exactly like the Bible said, when you're approaching the end of days. But, again, talk about interesting historical aspects. The Bible also said that Israel would become a united nation again. Now, for those people that aren't familiar with the Scripture, that may not seem like a big deal, but for those that do, that's huge. Ezekiel 37 talks about that, God said specifically he's going to unify them into one nation in the land. No longer will they be divided into two nations. And that's because, if for those of you who are familiar with the Old Testament, around 926 BC-ish, the Jewish people became a divided nation. Okay, you had there's 12 tribes. You had 10 tribes went north, and they became what's called Israel. Then you had the two southern tribes that stayed, and they were called Judah. Okay, and it had been that way when they regained their independence for the first time. This is how amazing this one is. For the first time in almost 3,000 years, Israel became a single nation again, not two. They spent the remaining part of their years as a nation completely divided. So again, they didn't just come back to the land. They didn't just become a nation again. They didn't just come forth in one day. But exactly like God said would happen, they are going to become a united nation again. And continuing on specifics, the Bible also said that in the last days, and Ezekiel 45 talks about that, because that's the passages dealing with the rebuilt Jewish temple in the last days. We'll get to that in a little bit. But he said specifically that Israel's currency would be the shekel. And he mentions it there that the standard unit for weight is going to be the silver shekel. And now the problem was, when Israel came into the land and was reborn in 1948 and continued to progress, they did not have the shekel. That was not their currency. It was the British pound. But, wonder of wonders, it all just happened to change in 1980. And that's when they brought back into existence the shekel, and it's the official currency of Israel right on up to today. Another one that the Bible said would be specific is that Israel would not just come back to the land, not just become a nation, not just be brought forth in one day. They wouldn't just be united. They wouldn't just have the shekel all of a sudden appearing on the scene again. But specifically, that Israel would blossom as a rose in the desert. Isaiah talks about that. He says that the desert will blossom with flowers. There's going to be an abundance of flowers. He specifically said the deserts will become green as the mountains of Lebanon. Now, again, most people, when you look at the news and you look at pictures and photos of Israel today, again, they might miss the significance of that, because it wasn't that long ago that Israel was completely decimated. In fact, a historical point would be Mark Twain. He visited Israel in the 1860s, and he reported that Israel was an absolute, just destroyed, desert, barren wasteland. And that's because about 2,000 years of abuse was on the land from foreign conquerors, and it left it a desert wasteland. In fact, when the Romans came destroyed Jerusalem, the temple, in 70 AD, that was part of the practice. When they would build siege ramps and things of that nature, they needed, wood to build that, so they would just basically get rid of all the trees and use it and stuff like that.
It's really very interesting. We have some watercolors that were painted in about the 1850s, 1860s by a very, very famous artist who was over there in Israel. And, of course, he has pictures of certainly Jerusalem as painted maybe from 10 miles away. And it's amazing to look at that. It was just, as Pastor Krohn says, just a barren wasteland. A few little shrubs here and there, but almost nothing there. And because you look at it today, and you realize, of course, that there are hundreds of thousands of trees there, certainly between Israel and Tel Aviv, between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And certainly that fellow's name was David Roberts. My wife corrected me, and that's what wives are for. But David Roberts, really a wonderful, wonderful artist, and you can still get his watercolors of Israel. But this is the way that it was 150 years ago, and yet today, why Israel has been totally transformed since, of course, the Jews returned to the Holy Land. Go right ahead, Pastor.
Yeah, and again, they just went to town when they got there. They began to not just plant a few trees and trying to get going back, but we're talking hundreds of millions of trees, even on up to today. It's a big, huge program that's going on in Israel. Some people have even done tests, and they've actually said that as a result of their planting the trees, it's actually helped to increase the rainfall in the area, which also helps. But one of the big, major reasons why it just literally, as the Bible specifically said, would blossom again with an abundance of flowers and the deserts would become green, is because they went gung-ho in building a massive network of irrigation systems, even desalination plants and things of that nature. They are on the cutting edge.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back with you. Go right ahead, Pastor.
And they're literally on the cutting edge of the irrigation systems, leading the path. And, boy, we could learn a lot from them. And so much so that because of their efforts and of doing that work with replanting and irrigation systems and that right now, Israel, the former desert, is now and has been the breadbasket of the Middle East. It is exporting its fruit all over the world. Anybody who's familiar with their fruit knows that it makes anything that California or Florida could produce here in America look like chump change. It's just amazingly huge. It's just incredible. Not only that, but Israel also diverted the water from the Sea of Galilee, and they channeled it into sections of deserts, and voila, hey, guess what? All of a sudden, in the deserts, they begin to blossom with an abundance of flowers, which right now, Israel is a major exporter across the world of flowers and ornamental plants, exactly what the Bible said. The Bible didn't say it's just going to get green and be nice again. It specifically said that it's going to get to the point where it's going to blossom as a rose in the desert, and that's exactly what we see today. The Bible continues to talk about, and this one should be a really big wake-up call for us, especially in light of just recent news with like what's going on with Russia and Georgia and the things of that nature. But the Bible specifically said that Israel, in the last days, you know, you're approaching, is when they would have a powerful military. And which is a really amazing feat, because you really look at Israel, it's like a little bitty country, and yet they're going to have some sort of a powerful military. And yet Zechariah said that on that day that God is going to make the leaders of Judah like a fire pot in a wood pile. They're going to consume right and left all the surrounding peoples that basically come against them, yet Jerusalem is going to remain intact in her place. And we've seen that ever since they stepped foot in the land back in 1948 when they regained their independence. Immediately they were honored after their independence with an invasion from Egypt and Syria and Jordan, Iraq and Lebanon. And in fact, to the point they were outnumbered 20 to 1, 20 million versus 1 million. And they not only won that war, but because of that, they expanded the size of Israel by 50%. And so much so that Israel is right now one of the most powerful military forces in the world, certainly hands down in the area, and they have full nuclear capabilities. And that's what we're hearing on the news all the time. In fact, what's interesting is that Israel is a so much so that they not only have a powerful military, but they have the ability to also train other countries with their military techniques and expertise, as well as they are a major exporter of arms. And that's part of the skirmish that's going on right now with Russia and Georgia. I just read just today, I had heard hints of it last week, but today I read the actual article that Russia is really upset with Israel because they found some weapons there. Now, what's interesting, again, from Bible prophecy point of view, Ezekiel 36 and 37 deals with Israel being reborn, becoming a nation, what we've basically talked about thus far. Ezekiel 38 and 39 talk about Gog and Magog. Ezekiel 40 and 48 talks about the rebuilt Jewish temple. We'll get to that again in a little bit. But right there in the middle, between the birth of the Jewish people and prior, after that, and then prior to the building of the temple, there's this prophecy about Gog and Magog, which most people look at the description, and you're dealing with...
Hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Pastor Crone was simply talking about one of the prophecies that Israel would bloom again, that the deserts would bloom. And, of course, certainly we've seen this in Israel going from a wasteland where it was into the in the mid-1800s to where it is today. Certainly one of the major producers of fruit and fruit and food and flowers being sent all over the world. And then, of course, another prophecies was that Israel would become a mighty military power again. Well, of course, you've got this little tiny nation with maybe 6 million people living in it. And yet, of course, time and again, when, of course, its enemies, the surrounding Arab nations, have come against it, with perhaps sometimes 20, the Israelis outnumbered 20 to 1. Why, time and again, war after war, the Israelis have won them. and of course certainly today, Israel is a major nuclear power over there. Little tiny Israel has nuclear weapons, but right now, of course, some of this is shifting, some of this is changing. Certainly our government, contrary to what most people understand, our government is doing everything they can to give military nuclear weapons to Pakistan. If you haven't read the Sybil Edmonds story, you should. You'll find it up on my website. I believe it's the January 2008 newsletter. January 2008 at RadioLiberty.com. And suddenly we find that there's a secret cell operating at the highest level of our government with the full knowledge of the FBI and the State Department that is supplying nuclear technology and material to Pakistan in preparation for the coming nuclear war over there. None of this makes sense, but I'm sure God knows exactly what's going to happen. I think we're going to witness within relatively few years God's hand once again protecting Israel. Because without God's protection, there is no way militarily that Israel is going to survive what lies ahead. So pick up the story there, Pastor Krohn.
Yeah, and that's just it. You know, if there's one lesson learned, it's one that God is not done with the Jewish people. He still has promises that he has promised back in the Old Testament that have yet to be fulfilled. But also is that if there's one group of people you don't want to mess with, it's the Jewish people. And they have God's protection upon them. And that's what we see again with this Ezekiel 30 and 39 with this Gog and Magog, and talking about this northern power that would arise with modern-day Iran and some of the surrounding countries in that area that would come against Israel. But the scripture clearly says that God is going to basically sovereignly protect Israel, and it's going to be a wholesale slaughter like we have yet to see on the planet to that degree. And yet that's exactly for the first time since, what has that been, about 2,500 years, we have never seen a northern power like Russia come into existence. Not only that, but Russia specifically. And again, people say, well, what makes this different than what we're seeing today? You are actually watching it happen before your very eyes in the news. You're seeing a northern power above Israel. You're seeing Russia, which again, you know, many people had thought anyway, that they had dissolved as a country, and of course not. But you specifically see them make an alliance with Iran. And that's never happened before. And now, even with this current conflict with Georgia, now you're seeing Russia, the northern power, vocally come out against Israel and really starting, you know, quite the ruckus. And so could this be the beginning of the fulfillment of Gog and Magog? Most certainly it very well could. But again, these things have never, ever happened before. That's what makes these times so special.
And I think they are very, very special times. And I think you'll find this whole series that Pastor Krohn has put together. And there are actually two sets of DVDs, each one with five DVDs. As you count down from 10 down to 1, we're talking about the 10th. And that has to do with the Jewish people and the other things. Well, what are some of the other things that were prophesied about the Jewish people?
Well, you know, going along with that, you can see it leading up to that Israel would not only return to the land, become a nation in one day, they become a united nation, they got the shekel currency back into play.
No, I think that's important. I mean, they said, you know, the currency would be the shekel. Well, it wasn't until about, 1980 that shekel did become the currency there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, again, but again, notice each one of these things as we go through this, these are very specific. This isn't like you might meet somebody new on the street today. I mean, you talk about specific, and these things were prophesied centuries before this ever took place. And again, that's why I started off with, to give you an idea of how profound this is. It's not just specific, but this is prophecy after prophecy after prophecy. That's why I gave the example of just 8 of them being fulfilled in any entity is absolutely, literally impossible. Meaning, if it were to take place, which is what we're seeing, it has to be something not natural, something supernatural. And again, that's exactly what it is. It's God's fingerprints all over it to wake up the planet before it's too late.
And I think it's so important. People understand there really is a supernatural realm. And of course, we're witnessing its activity and action at the present time. Well, Pastor Crowan, you go right ahead.
Well, and kind of leading up to that, you can see how this next one would come into place. And the eighth one that I share, the prophecy with the Jewish people, is that Israel would become a center of conflict for the whole world. Okay? Zechariah talks about that. And basically that all who try to come against it are going to injure themselves, Israel, and when the nations of the earth are gathered against her. And again, we'll see that at the end of the tribulation period with the Battle of Armageddon. That's where it culminates. But you got to think about it. Again, put Israel back in its context, not only with proximity, but its size. I believe the stat is 17 Israels, and it might be even more because they are continue to, unfortunately, give up land. But 17 Israels can fit in the one state of California. I mean, so we're talking just a little bitty piece of real estate on planet Earth. You would think, I mean, if somebody's going to cause a major conflict, it's going to be some big nation, somebody that's, you know, but little bitty Israel. And yet, wonder of wonders, Zechariah prophesied specifically that Israel is going to be a center of conflict. And that's exactly what we see every day. In fact, we see it so much on the news, I really think that it just goes in one ear and out the other. People don't realize that they are watching Bible prophecy before their very eyes. Every time they turn on the news and they see conflict in Israel, when they see people crying out for a peace treaty of all places in Israel, with Israel and with the Palestinians, the whole thing going back and forth and the bombings and this is Bible prophecy happening before your very eyes. And notice that their strategic location, okay, it doesn't stay with just them. You would think that, you know, why is this such a big news topic? Well, it's because of their location. They're right in the heart of the world's oil reserves. It's a strategic military location. And it also just so happens that it's headquarters for the three largest religions on the planet. Okay? So you talk about being a serious conflict, and not just from a military point of view, but from a spiritual point of view. And then, of course, with a real estate point of view. No wonder it's become an international problem, but people don't realize that that's exactly what the Bible said, that this little tiny piece of real estate would become a center of conflict for the whole world. And that's exactly what we see today. But not only that, the Apostle Paul alludes, speaking about that time in the book of Thessalonians, Paul says that while people are saying peace and safety, destruction will come upon them suddenly, as labor pains come upon a pregnant woman. Now, what's interesting, the word there for safety can accurately, probably even more accurately, although safety is a good translation, but it could literally say peace and security.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, certainly Pastor Crowan is pointing out so all these prophecies having to do with Israel are coming to be fulfilled today, and Israel today is really the center of what's going on. I mean, there are all sorts of things happening in Africa today. I mean, certainly there's terrible problems in Uganda, there are terrible problems in the southern Sudan, the terrible problems in the western Sudan, there are terrible problems in Rhodesia, but we don't focus day after day after day after day on those problems. Well, we do focus on exactly what's going on over in Israel and the areas very close by there. So pick up the story there, Pastor. Now, before we do, why don't we let you get your website out so people can know if they get to your website and get some of the information you have.
Sure. That would be www.niagarafrontierbible.com. That's NIAGARAFRONTIERBIBLE.com, niagarafrontierbible.com. Or you could just Google my name, Billy Crone, C-R-O-N-E, and that'll take you where you need to go.
All right, fine. So pick the story up from there.
Well, you know, and again, what you're dealing with is with Israel becoming an international problem. A parallel passage the Apostle Paul talks about in Thessalonians is that while people are saying peace and safety, or literally security, destruction is going to come upon them suddenly as labor pains upon a pregnant woman. Now, here is really one of those items where people are saying, well, what makes this time so different? Well, if you have any idea, and I think this is the problem, because people don't. They don't understand Bible prophecy, which is unfortunate. And so even though it's happening all around them, they're never going to get it. It's just going to go in one ear out the other. But if they understand this, this phrase, their peace and security, if you're paying attention to the news, you got people all over the news. They're not just crying out for a peace treaty with Israel, okay? They are crying out specifically this phrase, and I just challenge people to pay attention to the phrase when it comes to the Palestinians and Israel. What is the phrase that the leaders keep saying over and over again? And if you'll pay attention, they're saying this phrase, peace and security. Peace and security. President Bush is saying it. Even Obama is saying it. Cheney is saying it. General Wesley Clark is saying it. You got many people over there. You got the Palestinian president is saying it. They keep saying, of all things, peace and security. Peace and security. And that is exactly what the Apostle Paul said would happen. While people are saying peace and security, destruction will come upon them suddenly as labor pains upon a pregnant woman. That has never happened in the history of mankind. That's what makes these times so special. But what has also never happened is what we're seeing today. The Bible talks about one day the Jewish people would rebuild the temple. As I said earlier, Ezekiel 36 and 37 deals with Israel against all odds being born again as a nation. Ezekiel 30 and 39 talks about Gog and Magog, this northern power making an alliance with modern-day Iran and coming against Israel, and they're going to basically lose their shorts, to put it mildly. Ezekiel 40 and 48 is all about the rebuilt temple. And John picks it up in the book of Revelation, chapter 11. He talks about this temple, and specifically in Jerusalem. And so we know clearly, Old Testament, New Testament, that one thing you can expect to see during the tribulation is a temple, a Jewish temple that is rebuilt in Jerusalem. In fact, the Bible says that the Antichrist himself, halfway into the tribulation period, will go into that temple and declare himself to be God. It's at that point that the Jewish people get a wake-up call. Unfortunately, the Bible prophesies that two-thirds of them are going to basically pay with it for their lives, but yet God, again, he always has a remnant. He sovereignly protects one-third of the Jewish people. And because once the Antichrist goes in and declares that he is God in their temple, they obviously see the true colors, but then it's too late and he hunts them down. And it's going to make what Hitler did look like chump change, unfortunately. But the point is like, okay, that's cool. So we see that there's going to be a rebuilt specifically Jewish temple, specifically in Jerusalem, during the tribulation period, the seven-year tribulation period. The question is, do we see any signs of that today? Absolutely. In fact, phenomenally so. What we see today, I tell people all the time, please don't take my word for it. Do the homework yourself. Go to templeinstitute.org. You can see there not only that, you know, hello by the name, Temple Institute, that they have plans on rebuilding the temple, but they have already gone and spent millions and millions and millions of dollars rebuilding these things, specifically the articles of the temple, to the Mosaic Law prescriptions. They've already, you can go on their website, you could view the actual pictures of the articles that are built. And we're talking, they have spent some serious cash on this, so they are deadly serious about this. They've already redid the golden bells for the hem of the high priest's garment. They've already, the golden flask needed for the water libation ceremonies, the pure silver shovels for removing the ashes from the altar have been rebuilt. The silver and gold-plated ram's horn that will be blown in the temple services. And speaking of which, the silver trumpets that they're going to use to announce various temple sites. They've rebuilt, and they're still to this day, building the actual harps and the lyres and the various musical instruments that will be used in the temple services. They've rebuilt the wooden and golden lots to determine which goats that they're going to sacrifice in the new temple. They've rebuilt the golden altar. They've rebuilt the table of showbread, the laver. They actually already have, and they're encased in glass, the actual sacrificial knives that will be used for the temple sacrifices. They've rebuilt the garments for the priests, and specifically for the high priest. They've rebuilt the breastplate for that, and you're talking some serious cash there. Now, here's something that is really wild. You talk about these temple services. This tells you how close it's getting. For the first time, these people are not just getting ready with all the temple, the articles, and having them rebuilt, just sitting there ready to go. But for the first time since the destruction of 70 AD, they just recently not only rebuilt the golden menorah, to the tune of about $2 million. But they recently had a special ceremony, and they relocated it back to the temple area. That has not happened since the destruction of the past temple since 70 AD. Not only that, on the final countdown, I shared the actual video clips of that ceremony with the golden menorah, and also of two of the leading rabbis who are for rebuilding the temple. And they made an announcement this year, it's very recent, just a few months ago, that they had just completed the golden high priest crown. And they're on that tape. You can see it with your own eyes. They're smiling, joking, just elated, going, and we're waiting just for the right head to put it on at the right time. It could be very soon.
And I think it's really very interesting that they've actually been DNA typing to try to find the descendant of the high priest. And, of course, now they have the original DNA, I really don't know, but they believe that they have the actual descendant of the Levite, who would be the direct descendant of the previous high priest. Everything is in place. Now, all, of course, they need is to be able to build the temple. They can't do that with the Ark, or certainly with the Dome of the Rock. There's a very special Muslim temple there. But certainly the rabbis anticipate that God, in one way or another, is going to destroy that Dome of the Rock that's been there since the late 600s, shortly after Muhammad died, and that at that point then they'll be able to go ahead and build their temple. They're waiting for God to lead them to the next step.
Yeah.
Go ahead, ahead.
Well, you know, exactly right, and that's where some people would still, even after all this information, which I don't know how you could even scoff at this one, because it just keeps stacking up, and it's very specific. And again, remember, just eight of them, prophecies being fulfilled in one entity, is the same as that state of Texas being fulfilled with silver dollars. It's just unheard of. It's like, how many times does God have to wake us up and let us know? And he's being very redundant. And keep in mind, this is just one of 10 different Bible topics I deal with. This is just one. But anyway, so with the Jewish people, that is a dilemma, though. Okay, wait a second. So you can have all these articles ready to go. You can have the clothes ready to go. You could have the golden menorah ready to go. You could have the crown for the high priest ready to go. But how in the world are you going to build that temple, the Dome of the Rocks there? Well, what's very interesting when you do the research is there's actually a couple different schools of thought where they've done some satellite imagery with the topography. And some, a good group, do believe that it is there where the Dome of the Rock is, that general area. Some, though, believe that with satellite imagery that it might actually be to the north. Others believe it might be a little bit to the south. So this is what's called the north or the south theory. So technically, even with the Dome of the Rock there, it could easily be rebuilt. There's also others believe that, you know, God's going to do something, maybe cause an earthquake and destroy it, and then they're going to work out some deal and they get to build the Jewish temple. Some believe that even with maybe some of the recent heightened activity that we're seeing today with threats that a stray bomb or a purposeful bomb or missile is going to destroy the Dome of the Rock, and so then they'll have an excuse there. Some actually, I even heard this one today, some believe that, you know, maybe there is a little bit of room on the one side of the Dome of the Rock where the Jewish people technically could put, you know, a form of a temple there. Some people even speculated that maybe that's part of the what's meaning by this incredible tree that was spoken of back in Daniel 9:27. Daniel 9:27 says that the Antichrist is going to make a treaty with the people, Israel is the context there, for a period of one set of seven or 7 years. And that very event is the prophetic event that starts the clock ticking for the seven-year tribulation. And again, think about how incredible that is. Israel not just returning to the land, not just becoming a nation, not just in one day, not just a united nation. They got the shekel going again. They're blossoming as a rose in the desert. They're a powerful military. They're a world conflict, a world conflict. They're rebuilding the temple as we speak. But of all places on the planet, where is everybody crying out for a treaty? And yet the Bible predicted way back in the book of Daniel, probably 2,500 years ago or so, okay, that of all places, the Antichrist is going to be part of some sort of special treaty with Israel. And some people think that maybe that's part of this treaty is somehow that's you know, he's going to come in and say, you know, I'm going to do what nobody could say could be done. and I'm going to work it out, and this slick treaty that Israel will get their temple again or get to put it next to the Dome of the Rock or what have you. But, you know, and granted that is speculation, but a couple things that are important. One, we see everybody's wanting to make a peace treaty with Israel. We do know that one treaty that is on the table, might be on the table today, that we haven't just heard about yet, is going to be a treaty that specifically is going to be for 7 years. And the person who makes that treaty with the nation of Israel will be the Antichrist. But, again, even if it's not the temple as a result, they get to rebuild it as a treaty of the Antichrist, whether or not, there is still very good plausibility of them doing it, either to the north or to the south or, you know, again, a stray missile. But we can see it for the first time actually being a viable possibility. Now, here's what's really interesting is if anybody was paying attention to the news of what was going on in April, this is really wild. For the first time since the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, the Jewish people have not only made plans for the Jewish temple, they've not only rebuilt the articles for the temple, they've not only made the golden menorah and the high priest's crown for the temple, but for the first time since 70 AD, this year, I challenge people to check out themselves, they sacrificed a Passover lamb. They tried to petition to get it, of course, around the Temple Mount. Of course, the government said, are you kidding me? That's going to start World War III, basically. So they did one adjacent to the Temple Mount area and quickly sacrificed. That's how close we are. And that also tells you the depths of the, not just interest, but the dedication that these people want this temple and they want it built now. Now, again, what's the big wake-up call? This, what we are seeing before our very eyes, and these plans and these preparations, what we're talking about, is the temple. This will be the temple that is mentioned during the tribulation. This is it. We are watching it happen before our very eyes. We do not know the day nor the hour, but this is telling us just how close it is getting. A couple more very interesting notes. One of the things that is needed for the cleansing, there's a cleansing ritual that the Bible talks about in the book of Numbers about the temple being cleansed. And that is, you need the ashes of a pure red heifer. But the problem is, after 70 AD, pure red heifers no longer exist until recently. They just started popping onto the scene a few years ago. In fact, one of them came so close, I think the name of the heifer was Melody. And it came so close, but they found kind of a hair that wasn't pure, because it's got to be pure red heifer. And so it had slight blemish, so it was disqualified. But it just so happens that after all these years, after all these centuries, they're appearing on the scene again. And not only that, for the first time in man's history, we actually have the ability, in fact, this is what they're working on, most people have no idea, that we could create a red heifer artificially, okay, but still meet the qualifications, through genetic engineering and cloning. So even if one doesn't pop on the scene naturally or supernaturally from God, we could still create one. We just happen to be living in the technological times when man has the knowledge to make one. Now that is absolutely unheard of. That is what is diametrically opposed and what makes this time so special to, again, answer the scoffer. One last thing that I'd like to share about the temple. Very interesting information I came across just a couple minutes ago. It's an actual interview of two Jewish rabbis, and they share the account. They were actually some of the original paratroopers that landed and were a part of the 67 war in Israel when they regained Israel. And they actually, I think it was 14 years after that, 1981, they went back and they began tunneling. And they began to tunnel, and they feel that they have found the Ark of the Covenant. And just before they were getting ready to get to it, as they share, of course, a fight ensued because, you know, the folks came in and were stopping them. And they said, we were that close. We know it's there. We're that close. And what's interesting is one of those paratroopers, his name is Gershon Solomon. I challenge people to check it out. he is one of those people. Now, get this. He is not just a Jewish guy. He is now the founder of Temple Mount Faithful. The people who are behind this movement to get this temple rebuilt and rebuilt now. And he clearly says that, obviously, he must believe because he is now the founder of this Temple Mount Faithful movement to get this temple rebuilt. So he really believes that, that the Ark is right there. But he literally says it will happen in our lifetime. He says, you check me out, mark my words, it will happen in our lifetime.
Well, you hang on to that thought. I guess this evening has been Pastor Billy Crone, B-I-L-L-Y-C-R-O-N-E. You can go up on the Google and Google it in, get to his website, and we will be carrying these DVDs. We think they're well worthwhile. And my wife and I have watched them, and fascinating information that makes what's going on today have so much more meaning. Well, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program, so you go right ahead.
You know, one last thing I'd like to share is just now, there's two major events I haven't got to share, and one is we also see for the first time, again, to answer this skeptic, why is this so different? For the first time in 1,600 years, we have seen the rebirth also of the Jewish Sanhedrin. That's the same high council that was in existence when Jesus walked the earth himself in his earthly ministry. That is unheard of. That just happened a couple years ago. The rebirth of the Jewish Sanhedrin. Not only that, is we see a high expectation right now in the Jewish newspapers, and it's increasing, to where people are expecting the return of the Messiah. I share in the final countdown several quotes from Jewish newspapers, not only their desire of believing that the Messiah is coming at any moment, but they're coinciding that with the act of building the temple. One of them, article said that it is the act of building the temple that will establish the identity of the Messiah beyond a shadow of a doubt. One of their chief rabbis, Chief Rabbi Lazar, he said, the world today, listen to this, is in a state described by our sages as the Hevle Mashiach. That is, listen to this, labor that precedes the coming of a Messiah. And that's very similar to the words that Jesus used in Matthew 24 when he said, when you see these things, he says, you know, wake up, your redemption draws near. He said, but when you see these things, these are just the birth pains, the labor pains, if you will, prior to his coming. Rabbi Kaduri, he is calling upon right now the worldwide Jewish people to return to Israel. He says, quote, I am ordering the publication of this declaration as a warning, so that the Jews in the countries of the world will be aware of the impending danger and will come to the land of Israel for the building of the temple and the revelation of a righteous Mashiach or Messiah. Listen to this. He believes the Mashiach or Messiah is already in Israel. And of course, we know as Christians that would be a false Messiah. But still, that tells you that these people don't just have casual plans. It's going to be 100 years from now for this rebuilding of the temple. They want it, and they want it now, and they're just itching to go at it. It's getting closer, literally, week after week after week. And this prophetic significance is this is the temple that will be in existence during the tribulation. That tells us how close we are.
And I think we are living in truly prophetic times. Of course, every generation has felt that these were the end times, but never before have the children of Israel returned to the Holy Land. I think we're getting awful close, Pastor Billy. We'll look forward to talking to you next week. God bless. Bye-bye.
God bless. Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope that you've enjoyed our conversation with Billy Crone. We will be having him for 10 programs here as we go through the final countdown talking, but you'll certainly want to get the DVDs because there you'll actually see many of the videos, clips he's put together, which are so important. He's done an excellent job on that. That's why we're carrying it. And you can get, of course, the first set of 5, and then you get the second set of 5. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. It's called The Final Countdown. And then, of course, we have a 4-tape set. where is the Ark of the Covenant? And, of course, two of those interviews are with Ron Wyatt, who claimed he found the Ark of the Covenant. And I spent the last weekend with a Sephardic rabbi who actually believes that Ron Wyatt did find the Ark of the Covenant. It's a fascinating story. There are actually four tapes here. Where is the Ark of the Covenant? I think you'll find that material fascinating. Then we carry a fictionalized story. In fact, two books written by our good friend Ellen Gunderson Traylor. The first one is called The Priest, and it deals with what we've been talking about tonight from a fictionalized point of view. But Ellen, of course, went over to the Holy Land and spent a great deal of time there at the Temple Institute talking to all sorts of people. The second book in the series is The Oracle, and I keep threatening Ellen, you know, you've got to get the third and final book in that series done, and one of these days it will, but you can get The Priest and The Oracle. I promise they're the sort of books you'd pick up and you just can't put down, because it deals with this very subject and all of the proof it is that these are very, very special and important times. So remember our telephone number if you'd like to get this or so much other information from one of our catalogs, either on CD-ROM or printed. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Remember, we have a regular catalog, a health catalog, and an emergency food catalog. And then, of course, I do want to mention to our listeners that we have an opportunity to start doing an afternoon program, 4 to 5 in Spokane. Hopefully, we're going to start the 1st of September. But we should certainly use your help if you are in a position to help us so that we're going to be able to keep this going. We think it's a great opportunity to reach a large number of people there in Spokane. Drive time on KTRW, I think, is the call letters. Anyway, those of you in the listening on the American Christian Network will certainly know the call signs, but it's a great station. We have blanket Spokane, and we're doing this one city at a time, and Spokane drive time, what a wonderful opportunity. So if you're in a position to help, our number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Then I want to mention we are having our conference here, our yearly conference. It's going to be October 26th, all day long, North Shore, Monterey Bay. We'll have Dr. Blaylock, Russell Blaylock, talking on medical issues. We'll have, of course, Joanna Michelson, who was a medium, and, of course, her experiences coming out of the supernatural realm. And, of course, she wrote a book called The Beautiful Side of Evil back in about 1980. It is still a classic. We'll have Patrick Wood coming, who will be talking to us about what's happening from a financial point of view. We're only going to have five speakers, but you'll have a lot of opportunity to talk to them, to get their material. And now we don't want to cut things short. We want you to get as much information as you can. That's why we're bringing in top-notch speakers from across the country. So if you want to make a reservation, we need reservations for serving lunch. We need to know how many people are going to be coming. It'll be a great time. We've never had this many people signed up ahead of time as we're having this year. So remember, it's October the 26th. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927 if you're interested in coming. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, because we are involved in a spiritual battle. And there are powerful spiritual forces and secret societies at work out there. And, of course, we hope that you'll pray for our leaders and our ministers, because they should be leading this battle. And finally, please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Of course, you can listen to the next hour on the Internet, but we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hill, looking beautiful in picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be those of Mark Watterson. And we're going to be talking about his book, Don't Weep for Me, America. Don't Weep for Me, America. And it certainly goes into the background of some of the philosophies that we see at work in our society today. It goes into the background of the writings of de Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville, who back in 1831 was writing about democracy in America. And then, of course, one of the major architects of what's going on today, a man named Niccolai Machiavelli, who was actually, of course, died in the early 1500s. What does Machiavelli have to do with what's going on in America today? Why, he has everything to do with what's going on in America today. In fact, some of our primary foreign policy advisors are totally dedicated to fulfilling Machiavelli's dream of creating a new principle. Well, that is the background. Mark, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan, for having me on. I appreciate you.
Why don't you just go ahead and tell us a little bit about who you are, how you happened to write the book?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I'm someone who loves America, and I love to read about history. I love to read about political philosophy and government. And I guess I'm just as intrigued, at least to some extent, as, you know, the writers that have gone before us, you know, our founders of our country. We're always interested in what is the perfect type of government. And, it's so interesting that our country started out that way. And I like reading about it, and I like studying it. And it just frustrates me that the principles that were first set up for our country are long gone. And I'm someone who wanted to write this book so that I can try and explain to people what's going on in this country, what has been going on for the last 100 years, that they are being deceived. And, you know, I utilize Plato's cave and the techniques that Orwell talks about in 1984 to try and demonstrate how they're being deceived. And I feel like that, you know, I've done my country a great favor by trying to get this word out.
All right, fine. And so basically, what information are you trying to get out?
Pardon me?
What is the basic message of your book?
The basic message is that what we are being told is false.
Well, certainly no question at all about that. And, well, then where does de Tocqueville fit into this? Where does Machiavelli fit into it? Because I think these are two primary subjects you deal with, and they're very important. You cannot understand our country unless you understand de Tocqueville's writings. You can't understand what's going on today unless you understand Machiavelli, who lived, of course, in the late 1400s and early 1500s, and wrote a book called The Prince, and I've forgotten the title of the other one, but two books you discussed so well. And yet, of course, Machiavelli's philosophy is the philosophy of the neocons, and the neocons are the major driving force, or one of the major driving forces, behind the current administration. And we're seeing, actually, being played out today, the philosophy that Niccolai Machiavelli espoused 500 years ago. Only, of course, we have to understand that this will eventually lead to the destruction of what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. Well, Mark, you pick up there on the story and go from there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was surprised to learn in my research for this book just how relevant Alexis de Tocqueville is. You know, he's someone that, you know, I don't recall hearing about. I've got lots of education, MBA degree, accounting degree, and what have you. Not much in there about Tocqueville, but I picked up his book, Democracy in America, and tore it apart looking for what he had to say about America when he came here to study it in 1831, and it's a big book. But you know what? There's about, 15 pages or so in the book that are unbelievably relevant, because Tocqueville wrote about the threats to a democracy, okay, because he knew that republics don't last. Of course, Machiavelli knew it as well. Even our founders knew that republics didn't last. It makes you wonder why they even bothered to set one up. But Tocqueville has so many key findings in his book. He says that there is a type of tyranny that will eventually replace a republic.
He says, well, now he's really talking more about a democracy than he is a republic, isn't he?
Well, yes and no. He is fairly focused on a democracy, but he also understands. He's also talking about, republics in general as well. He's basically talking about, where the people rule. So, a republic is a representative democracy.
Well, of course, a republic really is simply a system by which the power of the government is limited so people can be free. It certainly is not a democracy. Our founding fathers did not want a democracy. Not one word of democracy in our Constitution or Bill of Rights, or the only place in the Federalist Papers talks about democracy, is to say we don't want a democracy, because of course it'll become a tyranny. Plato recognized that democracies don't work. But this really, of course, the first republic was the Roman Republic. It lasted for almost 500 years and, of course, fell apart because of the things we're doing today. But our founding fathers specifically created a republic knowing that it was the only form of government that might possibly allow continued freedom. Unfortunately, it has been circumvented. They've convinced us we're a democracy, and so many people tell us we're a democracy, and yet if you read the Constitution of every one of our states, now one of them mentions democracy. So we're really, we're not a democratic republic or republican democracy. We are a republic. It's a shame we lost it, but we'll be right back with Mark here. Go right ahead.
Yeah, that's very true. Exactly.
And all right, fine. You go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, that's very true. And, basically, Tocqueville, he's talking about, he says he refuses to believe in the duration of any government which is called upon to hold together 40 different nations, or states in our case, covering an area half that of Europe. So, talking about our small government back in the days of 1831, he says, this government's not going to last. And what's interesting is he explains why it's not going to last. And he says there's a new kind of despotism. And he says civilization has perfected despotism. We don't have the old weapons of chains and hangmen that we used to have. Now we have, something that leaves the body alone, he says, and it goes straight for the soul. He calls it a soft despotism. And he says he can't find a word for it. But he explains that what he sees in America is just a multitude of men that are alike and equal, and they pretty much spend their time in pursuit of, petty and banal pleasures, and, life just consists of him, himself, and his family. And then over this man stands an immense power, protective power, which is responsible for securing his enjoyments and watching over his fate. And the key here is that Tocqueville says that this power relieves society from the trouble of thinking. And that's where we got into trouble. We let our government do our thinking for us, while we were out, pursuing our own, personal pleasures and enjoyment.
Well, Curtis, one of the points you make in your book is the importance of a of a free press so that people can actually hear all sides of the issues. Unfortunately, we don't have that today. We have a controlled media. And today, freedom of the press does not mean that the press is free to print what it wants. It means that those who control the media have the freedom to censor what the American people hear, and that's exactly what we see. We can see this time and again, whether it be mention of the Bilderbergers. You'll never see this mention of the mainline media. Why? Because the people who control the Bilderbergers control our media, and so they're not going to let the American people in Europe know about it, people in Canada know about it. You can read about it on the Internet. You will never read it in the controlled media in the United States because they don't want us to know. And that was what de Tocqueville really feared, was, of course, one day we would lose the freedom of the press. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. That's exactly what I say in the book. That was the other thing, that once you lose your freedom of the press, you basically lost your freedom, because you've got to hear all the different viewpoints that people have, to keep your society strong and free. And I think today we have like 5 people that control the mainstream media, and they're all the elites, so they all have the same viewpoint. And we're all down in Plato's cave just watching the pro feed on the wall. And, nobody is the wiser. They just believe what the mainstream media tells them, and it's basically all deception.
Well, can you explain to our listeners what the Plato's parable of the cave was and why it's so important?
Yes, I did. There's a chapter about that. Basically, Plato's allegory of the cave is a dialogue that Plato wrote in his Republic, Book 7, between Glaucon and Socrates. And what's being described is man down in a cave, facing the wall, and they're chained so they can't turn around. But back behind them is a fire. And in between the fire and the chained men, there are people walking by carrying objects above their head. And those objects are throwing shadows on the wall. And the chained men can only see the shadows. So they don't know what the objects are. They don't know what the truth is. All they can do is look at the shadows and, trying to decide for themselves what the truth is. But they're just looking at illusions. And that's the American family today at home watching TV. We're watching the shadows on the wall of Plato's cave. We don't know what the truth is. We're just being fed whatever the elites want us to believe.
I certainly agree with that. And of course, what Plato was really in many ways very perceptive. It's well worthwhile rereading Plato's Republic. It's taught in philosophy 1A and in colleges all across America today. But it is pivotal to understanding what's going on because Plato, there's another interpretation of the parable of the cave. And what is, of course, that all we see are simply these images, of course, that give us some glimpse of what's going on, but we don't see reality. The other is that there really are two realms. There is one, the realm in which we live. The other is the spiritual realm. And all we will see from time to time are glimpses of the spiritual realm, which is the real reality. Now, certainly people have to understand that Plato was deeply involved in the mysteries. He was a disciple of the mystery religions, as was his teacher Socrates, as was Socrates' teacher 2 generations preceding that, Pythagoras, as was Aristotle, as was Alexander the Great. And, of course, certainly Plato actually taught a message in his classes, one for the common people, and that would be the initial interpretation that we're only seeing part of reality, we're only seeing shadows there. The other, of course, was to introduce them to the fact that there really is a supernatural power out there that you can tap into, but that was the message that only went to very, very special students. And that was, of course, the message of the mystery religions. And that is what is so poorly understood today. And certainly in colleges, most students who study Plato's Republic will never be told the true meaning of what he talked about. But go right ahead.
Yeah, and the second thing that I wanted to talk about is my book, Don't Weep for Me, America, is about why are we being deceived? Why can't our government tell us the truth when these events happen? And the answer is because the government's interest is not the same as the people's interest. The people, we have our families, yes, we have our enjoyments and our pleasures and comforts, but we want to remain free, although, it's hard to tell that, looking at society today with people, being completely apathetic about their government. But people think as long as they vote, then they're participating, you know, in their government. And Tocqueville points out that that is one of the biggest flaws in our system, is that people think that. They think that, you know, we, as long as they're choosing our schoolmasters is what he calls them, because we delegate our thinking to them. He says as long as we, you know, we think that because we choose them, that we're free. He says that's totally false, because you know, choosing your schoolmasters means you're going to trust them. And that's one thing we've learned that we can't do. We cannot trust the people that we've given all this power to, because they control everything. They control the media, they control the military, and you know, they're out there, you know, in foreign policy, you know, attacking foreign peoples for various reasons, and has nothing to do with the interests of the people. And we've given them that power, and we're totally fooled by thinking that just because we voted them in office that we can trust them, and that we just can't be that way.
Well, of course, the whole idea of the Founding Fathers was to limit the power of government so the corrupt men could never use the power of government to enslave the people. And our Founding Fathers realized that man is basically corrupt. So why would you want to give one group of corrupt people the right to regulate the lives of other corrupt people? And you were far better off to limit the power of government so men could be free rather than, of course, give any group power. It was that fear of power that was the very foundation of this country. It was the idea that we would have a government, but the power of government was to be limited by the chains of the Constitution, take the chains off the people, put them onto the government. How far we've come today, where we're, of course, taking the chains off of government and we're forging them for the people. So pick the story up there, please, Mark.
Yeah, exactly. And we've pretty much, you know, we've delegated our thinking to our government, and we've delegated our rights to the government, and the Bill of Rights are pretty much gone. You know, we're told that we have the right to redress our grievances. You know, we don't. We're told that we have freedom of the press, and we don't. And even today, because of the Patriot Act, you know, the government can be in your house, you know, searching your house while you're not there, and they don't have to tell you. I mean, you know, our rights are just so totally gone, and that's because we've delegated everything to an all-powerful government, and they are immune from any type of, you know, retribution. They don't have to tell the truth. You can't take them to court. And so where are you? You know, we think we're free, and we're so far from it.
I certainly agree with you. Go right ahead.
So another thing that's important in the book, when We From America and the Tocqueville brings up, although he kind of skirts around calling them the rich or the wealthy, but he does finally get around to talking about the rich, and he makes a very interesting comment that says that they will not easily submit to the laws of, you know, of the majority of the people, you know, who are supposedly, you know, the government who make the laws. He said that the rich will not easily submit to their laws, and he says that the rich have a great distaste for the country's democratic institutions, and I think that's interesting, and that's exactly why Tocqueville said that, you know, our government would not last, and that's why Abraham Lincoln predicted as much as 1864 that the wealth will be concentrated in a few hands, and it will ultimately lead to the destruction of our republic, and it did. And, you know, I claim in the book that that destruction pretty much happened in the year 1899 is where I say in the book, Don't Weep for Me, America, that the republic ended in 1899 because our westward expansion had been complete, California, and now, in order to increase profits of the corporation, we had to expand markets overseas. So that's when we began playing the game of dictators, where we manufactured a pretext for war, the Spanish-American War. You know, we set a battleship in the Havana Harbor. It just blew up. We blamed it on the Spanish, and we went to war with them. And then we went to the Philippines, and, you know, massacred them for 10 years and practically took the Philippines.
And most people have never heard of the Philippine-American War. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Go right ahead, Mark. Go right ahead.
Yeah, the our massacre of the Filipinos, you know, that's practically been expunged from the American history books. You know, I don't remember reading anything about that in school, and I was kind of shocked to learn about it when I was researching this book. I'm like, we went to the Philippines and massacred those poor souls for 10 years? Unbelievable. And
somewhere between 200,000 and 1.5 million were slaughtered or died of disease, a direct result of America's bringing them freedom. They didn't want us there. They wanted to get out of the tyranny of the Spanish. They wanted to get out of the tyranny of the Americans. But people don't understand that there were back in the year 1898, 1905, people who believed it was the manifest destiny of America to dominate the world. And this was the first step along the way. Turning our back on what George Washington had said in his farewell address about avoiding international entanglements, to having America begin moving to become the dominant force of the world. This is what it was really all about. But they could never tell the American people what this was about. The American people didn't want to be the dominant people. We wanted to live our lives, let other people live their lives. But there was a small clique of very, very powerful and wealthy people who have a different worldview, and in my estimation, they had that because they worshipped a different god. But you go right ahead, Mark.
Yeah, and so, you know, where we got this idea, I believe, is from the British. The British were, you know, pretty much out there conquering the world. You know, Alexander the Great tried it, Julius Caesar tried it, but the British were more successful than anyone before them. As far as ruling most of the world. I think at one time they ruled like 25% of the world. And that pretty much got passed on to us. Backtracking a little bit, you know, when England wanted to go to South Africa, they wanted to claim South Africa because one of their wealthiest citizens, Cecil Rhodes, knew that there was gold and diamonds there in South Africa. And so he created the secret society, which is, you know, told about in his wills, where the secret society's goals would be to expand the British Empire all around the world. They were even wanting to pick up the United States again, you know, as a pretty subject. That's how ambitious these guys were. And so Cecil Rhodes wanted to go to South Africa and pretty much take the diamonds and the gold, just like today. Today is oil. You know, we create this energy task force. Where's the oil at? You know, okay, go to Iraq. Cecil Rhodes and his cronies, they were sitting around the table saying, where's the diamonds and the gold? And that was South Africa. That was the richest spot in the world. And so they had to create a pretext for war. That's what you do in republics. You got to create a pretext to get everybody on board with you. And that pretext for them was called Jameson's Raid. Jameson's Raid is extremely important in our history because Jameson's Raid failed as a pretext, but two very important techniques came out of it as far as how the government works and keeps us deceived. And one very important aspect is their internal investigations. The government creates an investigative body to investigate itself. All right, so naturally, you're not going to get the truth, and they're going to put on a show for public consumption, and you're not going to find out what really happened. And, you know, we use that technique for the Pearl Harbor investigation, for the JFK assassination, and then again for 9/11, and all we get are lies because it's the government investigating itself.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with Mark. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Mark Watterson is talking about the effort to consolidate South Africa by the British Empire, by the British leaders, fulfilling the dream of Cecil Rhodes, first of all, consolidating South Africa and then beginning to consolidate the world under British and American control. And of course, one of the first things that happened at that time was something called the Jameson Raid. It was actually arranged by Cecil Rhodes about 1895, the whole idea was that Dr. Jameson, one of the underlings for Cecil Rhodes, was going to lead a group of the people from Botswana and South Africa on a raid. Supposedly, they were going to be raiding a group of blacks who had been raiding villages, but actually they were going to attack the Johannesburg that people, and most of the people involved, didn't even understand what it was about. But fortunately, of course, as they began riding through the Transvaal, the Boer, the Afrikaner Republic, they were intercepted, and Dr. Jameson was captured. And so the Jameson raid failed, but of course there was quite a furor in Great Britain. What was this all about? Why was this? The commando, they called them commandos of white soldiers riding on Johannesburg to attack Johannesburg. What was this about? And of course, Mark points out, what do? They have a parliamentary investigation whose purpose is not to reveal what happened, but to conceal what happened. That becomes the prototype of the Pearl Harbor investigation, the investigation, of course, of the assassination of President Kennedy, the investigation of what happened on 9/11. When government investigates government, do you really think that they're ever going to get to the truth? And the truth of the matter is, no. The Jameson raid cover-up was a prototype of all the cover-ups that have occurred since that time. But go ahead, Mark. That's a very good analogy.
Thank you. And the other extremely important thing that came out of Jameson raid was the creation of a hero story. The Jameson raid failed, but it was supposed to incite a revolt. And once that revolt got incited, then Cecil Rhodes' private army would join it and would eventually have war with the Boers in South Africa. Well, that didn't happen. So what they do is they create a hero. They create this hero so that it strengthens their story, and it also, you know, creates national pride at the same time. And the reason why that's important is because George Orwell picks that up in his book 1984 when he creates Comrade Ogilvy as a hero, and today we know that the American government also does that in early 07. We had the congressional hearings about, you know, the government trying to create a hero story with the Pat Tillman death, you know, saying that it was enemy fire and the Jessica Lynch rescue, and of course the passengers of Flight 93 in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. I don't believe that ever happened. I believe that's just another hero story, that, you know, a technique for deception that keeps us all in Plato's cave watching the shadows from what really happened.
In fact, really one of the great tragedies was really what happened to Jeff Tillman. What most Americans have never heard. I mean, they know, of course, the government lied about why he died. He was not a hero leading a charge up the hill. He was shot by his own people. What people have never been told is he had three bullet holes very closely centered right in the middle of his forehead. And the doctor, the army pathologist, who was, of course, was asked to do the autopsy, said this is obviously a murder. They could not let the American people know who fired those three shots into the middle of Pat Tillman's forehead. You can look this up on the Internet. We can provide you the information on this story. You're never going to hear this. I believe Pat Tillman was murdered because he was going to speak out against the absurdity of what we were doing in Afghanistan, against the absurdity of the war. And he was a war hero. The government had created him as a war hero, and now he turned against the war. And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, you do not turn against the people who control the world, or they will kill you. And three bullet holes in the middle of Pat Tillman's forehead, and you will never hear this discussed today. But you go back and read the original stories or Google it in. If you can't find it on Google, we'll provide it for you. Although many of the websites are being taken down that tell you the truth. But the information is there, or the people have actually pulled those down. I believe this is up on Alex Jones' website. Three bullet holes closely aligned together, and we're told, oh, he was shot by those fellas down the valley behind him. They just didn't know he was an American soldier. They knew exactly who Pat Tillman was. And somebody gave the orders to kill him, and everybody in his unit was threatened with imprisonment if they ever told the truth about what really happened that morning when afternoon when Pat Tillman died. And the fact that most of you have never heard the story of the three closely placed bullet holes in the middle of Pat Tillman's forehead simply is a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. We'll be back in just a moment with Mark Watterson talking about his book, Don't Cry for Me, America. Thank you. Well, Mark, why don't you go right ahead with the story there?
Yeah, and then there's a section in the book, Don't Weep for Me, America, about some of the stories that the mainstream media suppressed and deceived us on. And I thought it was important to include these stories in the book because one of the biggest hurdles for or one of the biggest impediments to people seeing truth is the fact that the mainstream media tells them the lie that they want to believe. And so people need to understand that the media is not looking out for them. And they should be able to figure this out. They're not buying these, you know, million-dollar commercial spots to the media. The corporations control the media, just like the government does. You know, they scratch each other's back. If the media doesn't report what the government wants them to report, then they're going to get their SEC license pulled. It's as simple as that. Or they get their sources cut off, official sources cut off, and they can't have that. So the media is just a mouthpiece. The mainstream media is simply a mouthpiece for the government. And so I've got a couple of chapters in here, Don't Weep for Me, America, on some of those stories that were completely suppressed. TWA Flight 800, for example, the Bobby Garwood story, the POW in North Vietnam who came back and proved to us that there were POWs in Vietnam, and we couldn't have that, so we had to court-martial the guy. And just that's one of the saddest stories I've ever learned about is the Bobby Garwood story. And then, of course, the election of 2000 by Greg Palast, who wrote about that while he was in England, and nobody in America even picked up the story. So I do have some chapters on some very specific examples of how the media deceives us with their reporting.
Okay, and that's a lot of fascinating information in your book. I certainly have enjoyed reading it. But let's talk a little bit as soon as we bring our other stations back on board about Machiavelli, because I think it's so vitally important that people understand who Niccolò Machiavelli was and why this Italian writer, certainly who lived in Florence 500 years ago, why his message is so vitally important to what is transpiring in America today. And, of course, the fact that most people have never heard of Niccolò Machiavelli, or if they have, they have heard the term Machiavelli and not quite sure what it means. But, of course, they do not understand how his philosophy really is the philosophy of the movement that dominates what's going on in Washington, D.C. today. So we'll be back in just a moment with Mark Watterson. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Mark, before we go on, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your website, how they can get your book.
The website is don'tweepformeamerica.com, or you can just simply call the 1-800 number at 1-800-788-7654 during business hours, and you can order the book.
One more time, get your number out. You always have to get it out twice on radio.
The 1-800 number is 1-800-788-7654. And please get some copies for your friends and for their gifts for their birthdays as well.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about Niccolò Machiavelli. Who was he? Why is his philosophy important to the American people today?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought him up again. I kind of sometimes get ahead of myself, but Machiavelli, you know, he was a Renaissance man, born, you know, around the Renaissance, at the end of the Renaissance in Italy, and he wrote a book called The Prince. He wrote that in 1513, and it was a short book. The Prince is about how to gain power and how to maintain power, and believe me this, there is nothing resembling morality in The Prince. Machiavelli says, you know, in so many words, you must be cruel. You know, you must lie, cheat, and steal. Pretty much do whatever you have to do to gain power and to keep power. And one of the most, that's why, you know, we hear the word Machiavellian. It's evil. And Machiavelli was, I guess, the founder of what's known as the noble lie. and you know, pretty much deceive people as much as you have to, lie to them, tell them anything you think they'll believe in order to gain power, in order to gain their vote, you know, if you're in a democracy type of government. But the key thing that came out of Machiavelli is the reason why you need to be evil is not for bad purposes, but it's for the common good. It's for the common good of your society. And the reason why that's important is because that explains why the FDR was willing to sacrifice 3,000 American lives and let the attack of Pearl Harbor happen. It explains the Bobby Darwood story, why Nixon allowed 3,500 American POWs to die in North Vietnam at the end of that war, because for the common good. And then, of course, 9/11, 3,000 deaths there. All of this is for the common good, and that number is interesting, about 3,000 people per incident. It's like they try and keep it right there at 3,000. It's almost predictable. But that's Machiavelli. These people are being sacrificed for what the government says is the common good. And, you know, that's the importance, I think, of Machiavelli. And then, of course, his evil principles are being practiced today in our government, probably most governments, if truth be known. And it's just amazing that statecraft, via the Machiavellian way, you know, is pretty much the law of the land around the world, I think, because... I think that's why we have all these wars. You know, war is so unnecessary, especially for this country. We're still protected by two oceans. We got friends to the north, friends to the south. There's no reason for this country to go to war. But yet we're out there bombing people every year, and it just makes no sense. It's total Machiavellian to further the interests of the wealthy and the one world government crew that are, you know, still trying to accomplish what Cecil Rhodes set up back in 1891. That they're on that game plan, and they get closer to it every year.
I think really what is so vitally important is to understand that, according to Machiavelli, you needed a war to rally the people behind the prince, behind the government. And that's exactly what it's all about. The end justifies the means. You have to be willing to be brutal. You have to use cruelty. You have to use violence and deceit if you want to succeed as a ruler. But the important thing is that not to do the right thing. The important thing is power, getting power, and maintaining power. And the prince must always be dedicated to war. Now, if you wonder why in heaven's name we went to war with Afghanistan, well, if we went to war, very obviously we had to get Osama bin Laden, the wicked Osama bin Laden, who had attacked America, and we were going to give the American people all the proof of that one day, but we just sort of never got around to that. But the truth of the matter is, of course, that was not the reason we went in, because, of course, we allowed him to escape, bin Laden to escape into Pakistan. So why didn't we pull our troops out? Because we never went in after bin Laden. We went in there because we wanted to control that country. And then, of course, why did we go into Iraq? Had nothing to do with Saddam Hussein. Time and time again, the Iraqi military tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and we wouldn't let them. And if you doubt that, there's a wonderful book we carry called See No Evil. See No Evil by Robert Baer, a CIA agent in Iraq during the 1990s. The book had to be cleared with the CIA before he could publish it. Robert Baer, See No Evil, he tells how time and again the Iraqi military tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and we wouldn't let them. The United States betrayed those courageous military officers in Iraq who wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and we kept Saddam Hussein in power. In fact, as Robert Baer says in the book, he never met an Iraqi who did not believe that the American government was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. Let me repeat that. Robert Baer, who worked in the Iraq during the 1990s for the CIA, said he never met an Iraqi who did not believe that the United States government was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. And yet, supposedly we're told that in 2003 we attacked Iraq to get rid of Saddam Hussein. No, it was all part of the Machiavellian concept. And basically, would you want to talk a little bit about the neoconservative movement, about Michael Ledeen, who Michael Ledeen is, who the neocons are, what impact they were having on the current Bush administration?
Yeah, and that's, that goes back, I don't know, maybe to the Reagan administration, but basically you got a group of people who share the same philosophy, and a lot of these are from the University of Chicago, and were students of a political philosopher known as Leo Strauss. By the way, Strauss was a huge fan of Machiavelli.
Right.
And Strauss would, he actually wrote a book on Machiavelli, and his students picked that up. They picked up the Machiavellian philosophy. But another book that they were required reading in the Leo Strauss class was Tocqueville's Democracy in America. That's one thing I point out early in my book, is that is a potent combination. If you have world ambitions, to read Tocqueville and learn about what has to happen to subvert your government, and then you read Machiavelli and find out exactly how to subvert that government, that's a pretty potent combination.
Yeah, I think I'm so glad you brought up Leo Strauss, because I think people cannot understand anything going on today unless you understand Strauss. Strauss was a Trotskyite. The neoconservative movement are made up of people who are dedicated to, they had nothing to do with conservatism. They're Trotskyites, they're fascists, and they believe in the all-powerful state as imposed by Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler. They think there's nothing wrong at all with that, because they're not going to tell you that. But the neoconservatives, of course, were following the teachings of Leo Strauss. But Leo Strauss was actually putting forward the philosophy of the ancient mystery religions. He told them about Plato. He told them how Plato always had two messages. One was for the common students. The other was for the very special students. And his students were the very special students. People like, Alan Keyes was certainly an example of that. And certainly many of the people who lead the conservative movement today, supposedly good conservatives, were students who were either trained by Strauss or trained by people who were trained by Strauss. And who were very close to the people who were related to Strauss. Certainly Alan Keyes was the roommate of William Kristol, who was Irving Kristol's son. Irving Kristol was one of the original students of Leo Strauss. But Leo Strauss taught them the message of the mystery religions. And that is, there is, at the parable of the cave, there's one message for the average individual. You're to believe that the shadows are certainly not telling you the whole story. You're only catching glimpses of the truth. But, of course, the other part of that story is that there is a supernatural realm. And within that supernatural realm is the real power. But only certain of the students were to get that message, as did Alexander the Great, who even wrote about this. And we have this in a book called The Times of Alexander, written by Plutarch about the first or second century. The fact that most people have never heard of the mystery religions, to see how they apply to what's going on today. But the disciples of the mystery religions are in full and total working control of our government today, and through the neoconservative movement, which Congressman Ron Paul has written about extensively, and of course Mark Watterson refers to towards the end of his book. But Congressman Ron Paul tried to warn the American people about the neoconservative movement and the Machiavellian beliefs. But of course most Americans have never heard what Ron Paul said. Wouldn't you agree, Mark?
Oh, absolutely, and that's not by accident. It's because the media has intentionally, kept Ron Paul out of the limelight, out of the stories. And I was just going to say a while ago, that is one of the most powerful weapons of media, and that's omission. So, a lot of people haven't heard of Ron Paul. Ron Paul says we need to get back to our first principles that were, which is what our Constitution is all about. And we should all want that. But the media, people believe the media when the media tells them, oh, no, you don't want to go back to, the old Constitution. That's outdated. People believe that. And so, we've lost our Americanism. But Ron Paul says, no, we need to get back to our constitutional principles. And Ron Paul is the man that we need running this country, because he's the only answer to us getting back to where we need to be. He needs to, you know, he will get us off of this course, this military course that the neocons have set us on. And you mentioned Michael Ledeen a while ago. Michael Ledeen, you know, him being a neocon and a Straussian, loves Machiavelli. He wrote a book about Machiavelli. I forget the name of it.
Hell of Machiavelli.
Yeah, I guess it is. Something I found in that book, Dr. Stan, is he brings out that the fact that Winston Churchill, okay, he pulled a Pearl Harbor a year before FDR did. Winston Churchill and his people, they broke the German code and found out that the Germans were planning an attack on the city of Coventry in England. And Churchill was faced with a dilemma. Does he tell them? And if he does tell them then to expect this attack, then the Germans know that their code had been broken. So Churchill chose not to tell them and let them be attacked. And a year later, you know, FDR, you know, pulls the same stunt at Pearl Harbor. Of course, we provoked that attack, and we knew that was coming. But Michael Ledeen tells that story, and you know, he was proud of that. He was proud of that story. I mean, you know, Churchill is a hero of the neocons for, you know, pulling stunts like that. They are for world domination. They have pretty much hijacked the U.S. government. They are running foreign policy. They are creating false stories about the yellow cake story in Niger so that we will attack Iraq. You know, I'm sure that they had lots of input on how to pull off this, you know, this 9/11 fraud. You know, probably has something to do with the Operation Northwoods. These guys, you know, they work in the Pentagon. They know all of the secrets, all of the plans that have worked before and that, you know, haven't been used, like Operation Northwoods, which was a 1962 plan where we were going to pretty much attack ourselves and blame it on Fidel Castro so that we could go to war in Cuba and remove Castro. So, you know, we've been playing the game of dictators for a century now, and the neocons want to keep pushing that envelope. They are all about world domination. They want to control the oil in the Middle East, because if you control the oil, then you control the world, because you're going to shut China down. You know, China is probably, you know, in the back of their minds as far as how they're going to deal with China. And of course, they know if they control the oil, then, you know, that will never become an issue. Who knows? They probably have something to do with this Georgia and Russian battle that's going on. Destabilizing that region.
I'm sure they do. I mean, actually, the Georgians were trained and armed by the United States, and the United States, certainly gave them the blue light that they never would have possibly independently have attacked South Ossetia without the permission of the people who were arming and training the Georgian government. So we gave them the okay to go ahead in there, and then, of course, we talk about how terrible it is the Russians responded to being attacked by, of course, attacking back again. They're not supposed to do that in this world. Go right ahead.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's the part that the neocons, you know, they're really interesting, Dr. Stein, because you can tell they're not only reading Machiavelli and Tocqueville, but they are very familiar with the techniques of propaganda that, you know, not necessarily were invented by, you know, the Cecil Rhodes people, but certainly they knew what it took to fool the people, and that's to, you know, control the journalists, control the professors, and pretty much control, you know, the writing of the books. And the neocons began writing their literature, I think, around 1992. They begin with the Defense Planning Guide, where they spell out, you know, what they want to do. And, you know, Dick Cheney had a lot to do with that, and he had to rewrite it and soften it up because it was so evil, basically. And so they continue to create propaganda methods. The Weekly Standard, you know, the neocons have the Weekly Standard. Cecil Rhodes had the Round Table. You know, same concept. The neocons even were able to buy a TV network called Fox News. And I make a point in the book that Fox is a good name for that network because that's Machiavelli, right? Machiavelli says a prince has to be as much fox as lion.
Well, if you remember, Chris Fox was really purchased by Rupert Murdoch, who I think is very sympathetic with that movement. He was the one who put up the money for Weekly Standard.
Yeah, that's correct.
And it's interesting that, of course, Rupert Murdoch owns Zondervan, the largest Christian publisher in the world today. Isn't that interesting?
That's very interesting.
Our guest, of course, is Mark Watterson. His telephone number, 1-800-700-7854. Is that right? 7654.
Yeah, it is 7654.
Okay, if I'm one more time, get your telephone number out there, Mark.
Telephone number, 1-800-788-7654. 5-4 to order the book, Don't Weep for Me, America. And the website is www.don'tweepformeamerica.com.
Okay, fine. Well, thank you very much. Our guest has been Mark Watterson's fascinating read. We'll be back here in just a moment. To wrap up tonight's program, Mark, just stay on the program, on the line there for just a minute before we let you go. Well, Mark, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program. Go right ahead.
Just a couple of some of the most interesting chapters in the book is I have two chapters on 9/11. One is entitled "How Did the 9/11 Attacks Look to the Pros Inside Plato's Cave?" And that's all the deception we got on 9/11. We're all standing in front of our TVs, down in Plato's Cave, watching the shadows on the wall, and all we know is what the mainstream media is telling us, and it's all a bunch of lies. The next chapter is how did 9/11 look to the people outside Plato's Cave, and those are the people who are able to do their own investigation and get the real facts of what happened on 9/11. So those are two of the more interesting chapters, following the chapter on George Orwell and his 1984 text, Doublethink and Crime Stop, and all those techniques Orwell throws out there as to why people can't believe the truth and why they're so easily deceived. The book wraps up with a plea on behalf of Ron Paul. We are so lucky to have someone like Ron Paul who has the courage to go against the establishment. He's got his rally for liberty, Liberty Rally going on in Minneapolis. At the same time as the Republican National Convention there, September 1st, September 2nd. Everybody needs to root for Ron Paul. Ron Paul represents us. We should all be rooting for Ron Paul because, these presidential candidates are not chosen by the people like they're supposed to. They're chosen by the media, and the media is controlled by the elites and the government. So the media tells you who your presidential candidates are, and, they control the polls, and Lord knows what's going on at the primaries. But the people do not select their candidates. And there's one piece of advice I can give everyone is if you vote for an establishment candidate, you're going to get what you've always got. You're going to get taxes, and you're going to get wars. And it's not hard to tell which candidates are not establishment. It's the ones that are being ostracized by the media. If the media is not talking about them, there's a good reason for that. It's because that candidate doesn't represent the elite. That candidate represents you. And there's a couple of candidates that started out that way. Now we just have Ron Paul, and he is the man to get us back on track. We should all be very thankful for Ron Paul.
Well, I agree with you. I want to thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate you being on with us this evening. Mark's book, Don't Cry for Me, America, fascinating analysis of what's going on today. And I wish you the best, and we'll be perhaps talking to you later. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stan.
Good night. Bye-bye. Bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, Mark Watterson, his book, Don't Cry for Me, America, has a lot of very interesting material in it. Certainly, we will not be carrying the book here, but if you'd like to get in touch with Mark, his number is 800-700-7654. I just want to take this opportunity to mention we are, of course, trying to get a opportunity to be on a station in Spokane, a large Christian station there, drive time every day, We already do an evening program there, but we're just going to have to pick up stations one at a time across America in major metropolitan areas. It's a wonderful opportunity. If you would like to help us, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. If you could make a commitment to help us for a specific amount of time, for perhaps 3 months or 4 months, something like that, just so we know we'll have the funding coming in, so we'll be able to pay for that station. So if you're interested in helping, our number 1-800-544-8927, so that we're going to be able to actually have that station in Spokane, and of course from there we're going to be expanding into other markets. But we can't do it without your help. So if you'd like to help us, our number 1-800-544-8927. And then I want to remind you that we are having our all-day conference here on October the 26th. It's a Sunday, and we're bringing in Dr. Blaylock. We're bringing in Joanna Michelson, who's a medium. We're bringing in Patrick Wood to talk on finances, and we hope to see you there. A call ahead of time. You would like to have reservations. We need to know how many people are going to be there, because we are going to be serving lunch. Again, that's the annual Radio Liberty Conference. Give us a call, October 26th. Right here in the North Shore of Monterey Bay, a beautiful time of year. And then, of course, we do hope many of you out there will go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. We have a section on videos. We have a section on other videos. We hope you'll go there. Watch Building 7 come down. We have videos of that. Important information, and we want you, of course, to get other people going to our website, recommending our newsletters. People can listen to our programs there 9 hours a day. We have, of course, our programs are in MP3. They're blogged, or certainly they're archived. The information is there. We hope you'll listen. We hope you'll get other people listening, because hopefully when people start listening, they start out thinking that, we must be crazy, and before long they're afraid we're not. And eventually they begin to see how the pattern works out. Fortunately, we have the Internet. People can check the various things we talk about and find out if it's true. And if it is true, hopefully many of them will want to become, like Paul Revere, help going out across their communities, letting people understand what's happening. The enemy is not in Georgia. The enemy is not in Iran or in Iraq or in Afghanistan. The enemy is in Washington, D.C. and New York. These are not people who are plotting to overthrow our government. These are people of great wealth who worship a different God. Because what most people do not understand is there are powerful spiritual forces which are energizing these people of great wealth. And that, of course, explains how they got their great wealth. Because many of them, of course, have made an agreement, a secret agreement, to gain power, but, of course, at a tremendous expense for eternity. If you have not, of course, heard my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness or read my book, you need to get it. You need to get my talk on the Forbidden Secret, and another talk called The Secret Knowledge. There's a syllabus that goes with The Forbidden Secret. You need to get it. You need to get my talk on the Planned Police State and the syllabus that goes with that. You need to get the DVD on The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. It takes you into the Rosicrucian movement that was organized, that came to America in 1640. With the idea in mind, they were going to take over control of our government and use our military and financial power to dominate the world. This is a group of people who worshipped a different God, who worshipped Lucifer. And the Rosicrucians are still here. They have a powerful influence on what goes on, just as do the Masons, the Theosophists, the New Age, and their subsidiary front organizations like the Bilderbergers, like Christie, the Club of Rome, like the Bohemian Grove, the Council on Foreign Relations. Pray for America, for our provision and protection.